Series. I'm Yoan Herrera, the director of PICA. I'll make two short announcements before we get to today's presentation. One is that I'm giving a talk tomorrow on the Russian presidential elections, if you have not heard too much already about that, for the UW Alumni Global Hotspots Series, which is at the Pyle Center at 1:30 if you're interested in that. And next week, our last meeting before the spring break, we have a history presentation called The Vavil Incident of 1937, Church, State, and Nation in Interwar Poland, and that's going to be Neil Pease, a professor from UW-Milwaukee. Today, we're very happy to have with us Aaron Peck and Jillian Landek from UW-Madison Medical School, and I'm particularly happy about this presentation because it's a nice interdisciplinary cross, even school type of interaction. As you can see, the title of their talk is has to do with, well, maybe you don't know what MDR-TB is, multi-drug resistant tuberculosis treatment in Tajikistan. And both Aaron and Jillian are second year medical students, and they went to Tajikistan for the summer, so they're reporting on their research. And I will just say, I think that this topic of public health in the former Soviet states is a truly interdisciplinary and truly interesting topic from a scholarly as well as a practical point of view. So we are very happy to have them here today. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for coming to this talk today. I don't know if many of you know, but this Saturday is actually World TB Day. So this talk, I guess, comes at an opportune time. As was mentioned, Aaron and I last summer had the pleasure of going to Tajikistan and doing a little research between our first and second years of med school. And we had the pleasure of working with a project there that's funded by USAID, and it's called the Quality Healthcare Project. And one of the areas that the project is working to address is the very high rate of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis in the country. And Aaron's going to go into more detail about what we did on the project while we were there, but we thought that we would give you kind of an overview of what multi-drug resistant tuberculosis is, and from kind of a medical and public health perspective, and then kind of outline the significance of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis in the former Soviet Union and specifically in Tajikistan. So I know we have probably a variety of different people from different backgrounds here. I noticed some med students and probably more from the humanities. So I hope I don't cause your eyes to glaze over with too much medical jargon here. I'll try to avoid that. Please interrupt me if you have questions along the way. But globally, a third of the world is estimated to be infected with TB. Most of these people are considered latent carriers of the disease. They contract it, and then because their immune system is strong enough, they never go on to develop any symptoms. But it's estimated that 30 million people have active infectious disease, and 2 million people die annually of TB. So as you may know, TB is an airborne disease. The germs are aerosolized and then transmitted when a person coughs, sneezes, speaks, or sings. I thought the sings part was nice.
That was on the CDC website, so we included it.
It's not, however, transmitted via shared household objects, such as sharing cups or eating utensils or kissing. It classically presents in patients as a severe cough, sometimes a bloody cough, night sweats, weight loss. Other things can present as well, but that's what we commonly see. And it's diagnosed in patients in a variety of ways. Some of you may have had a tuberculin or PPD skin test done if you've ever worked in a healthcare setting or in a daycare. And that's what's done in populations at large for screening purposes. So it's a simple test where you inject a little bit of protein under the first layer of skin, and then 2 days later come back. And if it's positive, if you've ever had TB in your life, there will be kind of a red raised bump there. That doesn't, however, diagnose active TB. So to actually diagnose TB, you have to get a sputum sample, or spit sample, basically, from deep in the respiratory tract and look for the organism, or get a blood sample. That's really the confirmatory gold standard. And then also on chest x-rays, you can see in this x-ray, that big cloudy white area there is a mass from TB. So the treatment for classical or drug-susceptible TB, as we call it, is a six-month course with multiple antibiotics. These are first-line antibiotics. And it's very effective. It's easy to cure people of TB if they're treated in the right way. But really the key to curing TB is adequate treatment. And the WHO in 1996 developed a strategy for addressing the TB epidemic globally. And it's called the DOTS protocol. And what that stands for is Directly Observed Treatment Short Course. And it's a strategy for training healthcare workers in the developing world to observe patients as they take their medications every day. So making sure they come to the clinic or that somebody's there in the home observing them and then documenting that they've taken them. It also helps to improve lab facilities, provides technical support, and then treatment guidelines to physicians for altering patients' treatment during the six-month course if there are any complications. So it's been very effective. Since 2005, we've seen a drop globally in TB rates. Unfortunately, in the former Soviet Union, DOTS was really late to arrive. So you can see in this graph here that much of the former Soviet Union actually didn't do that bad from 1990 to 2008, even though they might not have had the DOTS protocol in place. TB rates stayed pretty stable. However, in Tajikistan, and I'll go into this in a little more detail, but in Tajikistan there was a civil war from 1992 to 1997, and during that time we really saw this huge increase in TB rates. And it wasn't until DOTS training started to be put into place in 2002 that this started to stabilize finally. And in 2007, DOTS coverage was implemented nationwide in Tajikistan. So when people are treated for the full six-month treatment course, or they're not receiving the right number of drugs, they could go on then to develop drug resistance, and this is becoming more and more common around the world. You can also directly acquire MDR from somebody who has it, if it's aerosolized and you're in close proximity to them. But we see more often that it emerges in people that undergo treatment for TB but don't adhere to the treatment course. So globally, 5% of TB cases are drug resistant, which isn't that great, but in the former Soviet Union, it's much greater than that. In Tajikistan, 23% of TB cases are estimated to have drug resistance. And within that 23%, it's kind of broken down into two numbers. 16% are new cases, and then 61% are amongst people who have been treated in the past and then went on to develop drug resistance. So this is just a map of the proportion of people who were previously treated for TB that develop MDR. So as you can see, it disproportionately affects the former Soviet Union. 27 high-burden MDR countries have been identified, and 14 of those are in the former Soviet Union. There's not a lot of great data on MDR rates in much of the world, but particularly there. There's only been one drug resistance survey that was conducted in Tajikistan in 2009 and 2010. So we don't have a lot of numbers on this, but yeah, from what we do know, the rates are significantly higher there. So after patients are diagnosed with MDR, the treatment changes significantly from those who have drug-susceptible TB. They have to receive a second-line antibiotic course for 18 to 24 months. And the drugs that are used to treat MDR are much more toxic than first-line antibiotics. At one point or another during your treatment, most patients complain of nausea, headaches, hepatitis, psychiatric side effects, hearing loss, loss of sensation and extremities. It's really significant. It's a really devastating treatment. And it's also incredibly expensive to treat. The average cost for a treatment course for MDR is $5,000, and the annual GDP in Tajikistan is $2,000, so clearly patients can't afford to purchase these drugs on their own. And not only that, because so many people develop side effects, they're often prescribed drugs to treat the side effects, to alleviate those symptoms, and they're asked to pay for those out of pocket. None of that's covered by the national programs that are in place. And there's significant follow-up. A lot of labs and x-rays are ordered, so you have to travel to get those labs and x-rays done. And because you're so sick, you're often not able to continue working, and so just ordinary living expenses become really significant. And as you can imagine, with a disease like MDR, TB, the patient education component is huge. It's really complex, and it's so important that people understand how they develop drug resistance, the length of the treatment, what they might experience during the treatment, who they can ask questions of, and receive some emotional support for what they're going through. And also so that they don't go on to then transmit it to people that they're around. So to just kind of illustrate the cost of MDR globally, this is just a projection of how much it would cost to treat MDR worldwide. So in 2012, we're already above $2 billion to treat MDR, and most of the money to treat MDR comes from the Global Fund. It's affiliated with WHO, and it barely makes a dent in the amount of money we would need to cover the cost of these drugs. So most MDR is currently going untreated. So what's unique about Tajikistan? After they gained independence in 1991, as I mentioned, from 1992 to 97, they were in a civil war, and so effectively the physical infrastructure deteriorated, and government services weren't being provided, so nobody was really receiving effective health care during that period of time. And so since that time, people have become really dependent on foreign aid. Most of the social services in Tajikistan are provided through international aid groups in one form or another. And it's considered the poorest of the former Soviet republics. Because there are so few jobs in Tajikistan, half of working age males are estimated to migrate abroad to find work. And most go to Russia, some to Kazakhstan, but a significant amount of the population. So I'll just briefly kind of walk you through what the healthcare infrastructure in Tajikistan is like. It's really a remnant of the Soviet-style healthcare system. So you have three tiers of healthcare provision there. There's a national tier, so the bigger hospitals in Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan, are within that tier, and then regionals, so smaller mid-sized hospitals, and then smaller yet outpatient clinics are within the district tier. So these different tiers really have completely different financing and service provision mechanisms, and there's not much coordination between them. So it really creates kind of a fragmented system. And so when somebody's diagnosed with TB, they're typically sent to the National TB Hospital in Dushanbe, and they'll undergo what's called the intensive phase of treatment there. So until they are deemed to not be infectious anymore, they'll receive treatment there, and then they'll be discharged to outpatient clinics. There are some exceptions to that, but that's commonly what's encouraged by healthcare workers. So in terms of TB testing, in 2007, the infrastructure was really kind of built up to provide TB testing nationwide. So there's microscopy available throughout most regional hospitals in the country. There's only, however, one central, what's called a drug susceptibility testing lab, and that's in Dushanbe. And so that's the only place that you can diagnose somebody with MDR. And it takes 90 days to run the test. So sending samples from some of the more remote regions of the country takes quite a while. There's a new test that's emerged recently called GenExpert, and there's a lot of hope around this test that it'll kind of change the face of MDR. It only takes 2 hours to get the results back for this, so it's a point of care testing. And there's two machines that were brought to Tajikistan in September of last year, but they're, from what I understand, they're only in place at HIV-TB clinics, and so they're not really available to the population at large. So hopefully this will be used more down the road. Tajikistan has received 3 rounds of Global Fund funding beginning in 2004. In 2009, $12.6 million was received, and a big portion of this was allocated to treating MDR and securing second-line drugs from what's called the Green Light Committee. That's part of the World Health Organization that secures basically lower-cost second-line drugs to distribute to the developing world. And so they were able to purchase drugs from the Green Light Committee in 2009. So they enrolled the first cohort of MDR patients. This was the first time they started actually treating people for MDR. And 52 out of 319 people that were diagnosed in 2009 started treatment. And then in 2010, 400 more people were enrolled in treatment. And unfortunately, the situation seems a bit tenuous around the second-line drugs that should be coming from the Green Light Committee. 300 patients were planned to be enrolled in 2011, and last we heard, none of those have started treatment. So, next thing like we'd like to do is show a short video clip that kind of goes into more detail about some of the issues that I've talked about as it relates to Pakistan. Actually, Pakistan has a great community health program in place for treating MDR. This is just a short clip from New York Times, and then Erin will speak about our project. Any questions?
I was wondering about the difference between the amount of MDR in the U.S. versus Western Europe. It looked like what period?
I don't have the numbers.
They were drastically different, but I was surprised that there was such a difference there, particularly with the generalized healthcare in Europe. Mm-hmm. So any idea of the why of that?
My speculation would be probably just in terms of proximity, like geographic proximity, that because we're seeing pretty high rates in Eastern Europe, just the movement of peoples in that region versus the U.S. But
and in Tajikistan, are they seeing a high co-occurrence with HIV and tuberculosis, or is not?
They are, yeah. And there's some surveys going on right now surrounding that. That's a focus of the USAID project as well, as targeting co-infection. But
shall we?
Myla Ashfaq is on an impossible mission.
Right now, it looks.
Myla Ashfaq is on an impossible mission.
So right now we're going to see a TB patient who is essentially the mother of her family, because she's a 16-year-old. Her mother passed away with TB 2 years ago, and her father died 8 years ago of another disease.
Ms. Ashfaq goes door to door through the dead slums of Karachi. Her job is to contain drug-resistant tuberculosis, a lung disease that often kills entire cells.
I'm gonna give you all this.
Drug resistant.
Sorry, we're gonna try to show it again at the end. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I think if you let it go until it.
If you let it load?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It'll load.
So it'll, everything. That bar on the bottom.
The browser wouldn't matter.
Right? I don't think so. I think it's just a slow connection. So
okay.
If you let it.
What do we know about that? HIV rates in Tajikistan?
I wish I had those numbers with me. I don't know off the top of my head what the figure is, but I know that it's primarily seen amongst IV drug users more than other groups. We originally, when we were asked to develop our survey, we wanted to talk to patients about HIV co-infection and kind of see how that influenced their knowledge about their disease status. And it's actually pretty strongly discouraged to reach that topic with the patients because it's so highly stigmatized there that they felt that, in just the setting of sitting down and talking to people about about what it's like to live with MDR, that if you brought that up, they would probably shut down and not want to continue talking to you. So
the TB infected population also heavily drug users or not?
No. Just when co-infection really is. The TB population is primarily for primarily those who have limited access to health care or are immune compromised for other reasons.
Why are there so many MDR cases as opposed to just cases of normal tuberculosis, non-MDR?
Yeah,
we'll get into that a little bit with our data, but many of these patients have had treatment for classical TB, and they may or may not have had MDR to begin with, for one thing, and were improperly treated, or they started treatment and stopped treatment, interrupted their treatment, and thus those strains of bacteria were able to become resistant to the drugs.
So you don't get MDR unless you already have been treated?
No,
you can get it directly, but because it usually is a small proportion of total TB cases, you're more likely to get drug susceptible or classic TB. But
I mean, overall, the problem is really a result of inadequately treating TB the first time when it's susceptible to drugs, not receiving enough drugs or not receiving them for a long enough period of time. And then because it emerged due to that, it's been spread and aerosolized and
more of a public health
issue.
Okay, we'll try this one more time. And if it's normal, keep going. Mm-hmm. If it's not, I'll just start talking. Oh, this makes me sad.
Myla Ashfaq is on an impossible mission.
So right now, we're going to see a TB patient who is essentially the mother of her family.
You need to close your eyes.
Because she's a 16-year-old. Her mother passed away with TB 2 years ago, and her father died 8 years ago of another disease.
Miss Ashfaq goes door-to-door through the dense slums of Karachi. Her job is to contain drug-resistant tuberculosis, a lung disease that often kills in Pakistan. Drug-resistant TB is a disease of the poor, and Sumaira is one of its most dire victims.
The biggest thing is that there's no guardian here who can take care of us and relieve our stress.
At 16, Sumaira has a contagious, life-threatening illness, and she's in charge of her 6 siblings. They live together in this room. Sumaira is one of 900 contagious people living with drug-resistant TB in Karachi.
The unidentified 32-year-old man remains locked in this Atlanta hospital.
In America, drug-resistant TB patients are quarantined, and even one case causes fear.
One man carrying a deadly disease from entering the country.
Drug-resistant TB can be cured with antibiotics.
You have to take 8 in the morning and 8 at night.
But only by taking them every day for 2 years. But in Pakistan, most patients stop taking their pills if they feel better. Others are embarrassed by the social stigmas of the disease, and they hide their illness.
A lot of our patients have come to the point when they feel like, you know, I have so many side effects, I'm not getting better, and I'm ready to give up.
After 5 months of antibiotics, Sumaira is exhausted, depressed, and dizzy. She has 19 months to go.
And the way they earn is through doing handiwork on cloth and selling that. But since she's been sick, she hasn't really been able to do that because she's been unwell and she's tired all the time.
The family earns $50 a month selling textiles. As her productivity dips, so does the family's meager income.
This is a rented house and we can't work properly for 2 months. And you have to pay for electricity and gas bills. There's no peace of mind because of our stress. So how can we eat properly?
To keep the family afloat, Ms. Ashfaq's clinic provides food rations. And it covers the price of antibiotics, $4,000 per patient. The clinic is run by the Indus Private Hospital and funded by wealthy Pakistanis. They hope to expand across the country, where thousands suffer from drug-resistant TB. The disease spreads by coughing and breathing. But in Sumaira's unventilated room, the only option is a mask, and she doesn't wear one. It's only a matter of time until her siblings get drug-resistant TB.
I can ask them to wear a mask, but it's in a way unreasonable because when I have wearing this mask for 4 hours, it gets very tedious. So, I mean, the most I can say is that when you cough, if you feel like coughing, you cover your mouth and you stay outdoors as much as possible. And I just hope that they do that.
At the clinic, as patients come in to pick up their weekly drug supply, Ms. Ashfaq faces another barrier.
It's strange because, I mean, there are people out there who do a lot to get someone visiting their house on a weekly basis, on a daily basis rather, and taking care of the patient. But in this case, she is adamant that she doesn't want anyone.
When we began our program just about a year ago, there was an initial reluctance on the part of the government and the Ministry of Health to accept how big a problem drug-resistant TB was in the country at the
beginning. Amir Khan's an American-trained doctor from Pakistan. He's the director of the TB clinic at Indus.
Once you say that there is a problem, you own it, and you have to fix it. And this is a problem that is very, very difficult to fix. What we said was, if we take this challenge on, maybe we can convince the government that it can be fixed.
We have a heavy rush over here.
The government's health system is severely underfunded, and clinics like these are overwhelmed.
There are more than 100 patients in the outside, and these are all tuberculosis patients.
The crippled system leaves the fight to private facilities like Indus. But their pilot project treats only 50 patients. Others are waitlisted, and new cases are constant. Bimish is 15. She has a troubling cough, and she's here to find out if she's caught TB from her father.
It's my name.
He wears a mask at the clinic, but he rarely wears one at home.
So, अब मसला ये है कि जो आपकी बीमारी है, आपके वालिद की जो TB की बीमारी है, वो तुम्हारी भी बरकत में आई है, ठीक है? और इसी को आपसे ही किसी पॉइंट पे लगी है।
I think the cause is certainly worth it. The people who walk the streets in the heat, literally day and night. I don't think we find a reason to get tired. I think because each one of these stories, each one of them is so motivating. Each family that's been devastated by TB encourages you to just keep going.
Thank you.
simultaneously uplifting and upsetting video, but a good segue into talking about the issues in Tajikistan, because a lot of these issues are relevant in Tajikistan as well. So I'll start with just telling you a little bit about USAID's work on health in the Central Asian region. USAID has been working in Central Asia since the early 90s, and improving primary health care is one of their main goals. And they're addressing this through the Quality Health Care Project called the QHCP. And the QHCP serves the five Central Asian countries, and among its primary goals are to try to control infectious disease in the region, including tuberculosis. This program is currently running for 5 years and has a $72 million budget, which, as you can see, is small in relation to what's needed for TB alone. And it's currently being implemented by some contractors, including Apt Associates and Project Hope. Our time in Tajikistan was mainly spent developing and administering a survey to MDR TB patients and to healthcare workers. And we were very interested in gaining insight into particular challenges that these patients might have in accessing or continuing their TB treatment, and that might have compromised their ability to complete treatment. So these are just a few of the questions that we included in the surveys. For the patients, we mainly focused on demographics, previous TB treatment, MDR awareness, economic and geographic barriers, and then stigma and discrimination. And then as kind of a complimentary survey, when it was possible, we interviewed providers about their ability to care for these patients and also what they perceived to be the main barriers for the patients. We did this through the help of translators. We interviewed the patients in Tajik and most of the providers in Russian, because they get their medical education in Russian. And then we compiled the data and analyzed it. And we were able to interview 50 patients and 21 providers. So I'm just going to share some of our findings with you, focusing on the patient data. Almost all of the patients that we talked to were unemployed. And as Jillian mentioned, this really compromises their ability to care for themselves and then also to provide for their families. And also, echoing what Jillian said, a lot of these patients had to migrate out of the country for work, and we saw that in our patient population as well. Almost 40% of them migrated, mostly to Russia, and almost all of them were male. Half of them were diagnosed while they were out of the country, and due to unaffordable medical care, most of them were unable to start treatment immediately. And those who were often couldn't continue the full treatment course due to costs. When we asked patients about their previous TB treatment, we were dismayed and unsurprised to see that over 80% of patients had previously been treated for TB. Of these 42 patients, almost 70% of them reported not being cured at the end of their treatment. But a lot of them, as you can see, didn't have the full six-month course for their treatment. And as was mentioned in the video, a lot of these patients would stop their treatment when they felt better, or if they had to leave for work, they'd have to stop their treatment. So collectively, we think that this likely contributed to the drug resistance in many of these cases. Sorry about the graphs here. Thought it would work better coming on my Mac. But when we asked patients about their knowledge of TB, they generally had a good idea of how TB was transmitted. So TB and MDR-TB are transmitted the same way, through the air, in close contact with an infected person. But some patients thought it could be transmitted through other means like cold weather, stress and depression, so it's not completely clear to these patients. And a lot of these patients did not know from whom they had contracted their disease. 80% of the patients couldn't report a source for their illness. And more importantly, patients just don't really have a good understanding of what MDR-TB is. We asked them if they had had MDR-TB explained to them by a health provider, and a lot of them said yes, and we followed that question up with, well, what did they tell you? And then they weren't able to understand the concept of drug resistance. So that's definitely an educational gap. But the majority of the patients did understand that the length of MDR-TB treatment was quite a bit longer than the classical TB. So we asked the patients about side effects, and almost all of them reported experiencing side effects sometime during their treatment course. And the majority of these patients did end up taking some side effect medications, whether it be medications or herbal remedies, anything that they could do. We had a small list of side effects and asked them if they had experienced any of those. We thought those were the most commonly reported ones, but we had another category as well, and we just got a whole laundry list of side effects that these people are experiencing. So you can see that 22% of the patients stopped treatment at some point because of side effects. So this is a serious concern when it comes to treatment adherence. Also, the patients are expected to pay for these medications out of pocket. As Jillian mentioned, the Global Fund is only covering the antibiotics themselves. So when asked about economic constraints, side effect medications were among the largest expenses these patients had. They also needed to pay for their own transportation if they were going to go to clinics to get the treatment, and also having to pay for their own food. And 80% of the patients reported no income. As you can see, most of them were unemployed, and so this is a huge problem. How are these patients going to be expected to take this two-year treatment course when they're unable to have these other factors supporting them, such as their side effect medications, for example? So we ended our survey touching on a sensitive topic, stigma and discrimination. And when we asked the patients about their primary concerns, they were mainly concerned about infecting others, being cured themselves, and losing their livelihood. The MDR-TB diagnosis definitely had a negative impact on many people's relationships. They reported family or friends distancing themselves. The patients tried to avoid others so as not to give others the disease, or perhaps because they were concealing it. And so as a result, relationships deteriorated. This was a bit subjective, but it did seem that the women were disproportionately affected by their TB diagnosis. A number of them had said that once they learned their diagnosis, that their husband's family rejected them. Some of these responses also were that they were worried about being able to be married, or worried that their husband would abandon them. On the flip side, a lot of the men we spoke to, we asked them, how does your wife treat you now that she knows your diagnosis? And a lot of them would say, she supports me. So that was an interesting finding. And then collectively, among men and women, about a quarter of the patients admitted trying to hide their diagnosis. So this disease continues to be incredibly stigmatizing despite the prevalence. So just to summarize some of our results, we do believe that migration is contributing to the acquisition of MDR-TB and the resulting delay and interruption of treatment for these patients. So you could possibly consider it a risk factor in this case. Over 80% of our patients had said that they had previously been treated for TB, and it seemed that it was improperly managed, and this probably contributed to drug resistance. There are still existing educational gaps for these patients. They need to have a better understanding of what MDR-TB is, and the fact that if they don't take their treatment for classical TB, it's not uncommon for them to progress to this drug-resistant state. Economic barriers are a huge issue and may impact treatment adherence. And lastly, stigma discrimination is a huge underlying problem. And these patients, as a result of this diagnosis, may have a lack of social support, may try to hide their diagnosis, and that makes it even harder to want to continue on and finish the treatment. So where do we go from here? After being in Tajikistan for about 5 or 6 weeks this summer, these are some of our recommendations. We believe that there needs to be improved collaboration between partners in Tajikistan. As we mentioned, USAID is working closely with Project Hope on this project, but given the issues around migration and infectious disease, we think they could work with another organization in the country called the International Organization on Migration, IOM. We actually went to talk to them, and they have some monies through the Global Fund as well. They're currently trying to address the HIV issue with migration, but this is clearly a huge problem. As Jillian mentioned, Tajikistan is highly reliant on international aid, and so in order for these patients to complete the treatment course, they're going to have these Global Fund monies for the time being. But another secure drug supply needs to be available. And lastly, we just wanted to mention a few recent studies. that have been successful in implementing MDR-TB management in resource-limited settings, including Peru, Russia, Lesotho, and Haiti. And they've achieved this by minimizing these patient-incurred costs, these extra costs for medications, tests, transportation, and food. And they've also tried to target the vulnerable populations, which include migrants and prisoners. And I'd just like to talk to you a little bit more about the community-based treatment model, which has also been very successful. So according to this model, patients are treated in their homes for the majority of their treatment, or sometimes at nearby clinics, rather than spending a lot of time in the hospital. This is still under the DOTS protocol. In this case, community healthcare workers will come and observe the patients taking their treatment every day. And this provides advantages over being in the hospital. First of all, it reduces the risk of institutional transmission to any uninfected persons who are in the hospital because the controls there are not optimal. We wore masks, but there were definitely people who weren't wearing masks. It's not like it here is here in the U.S. So this is also a more cost-effective measure, and it also avoids the limited hospital bed issue. So as these rates continue to rise, the hospitals are filling up. There's just they're at their max, and so this could get around that issue. And just to show an example, Peru has been very successful in treating MDR. They've treated over 15,000 patients since 96, and they boast the highest cure rates for MDR of 75%. So this definitely can be successful as long as there's support. And Tajikistan already has a volunteer workforce in place of healthcare workers. It's called the Red Crescent Society. It's kind of like the equivalent of the Red Cross here. And so we just think that if there's more organization and support for this program, that this could be a useful way to try to control MDR in the country. And that is the end. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. We went through a couple iterations of it. We're pretty happy with it at the end. There are always more questions you wish you could ask, or you know, there's the translation issue as well, because we weren't sure how we were going to do it. We thought maybe we'll make up the survey and then the translators will go out and conduct the survey. But we actually got to participate. We would sit in on the interviews, read the question in English, the translator would translate it, get the response, and read it back to us. And so there's certainly stuff lost in translation, too. But overall, with the guidance and the amount of time we had, I think we learned something. A lot of it, again, was maybe kind of expected, and it's similar to what you're seeing, but there's just not a lot of data on Tajikistan, so clearly it needs to be more publicized. So.
Yeah, it was a short time, 6 weeks, but we were really well supported by the USAID office there and the Ministry of Health, and everybody was incredibly helpful in scheduling interviews with patients. I mean, it was unlike anything that could happen here. You know, if you were to go in and try to conduct a survey at UW Hospital, it would take so much longer. But it was incredible how we could call people up, and they were so willing to help us. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, everyone was helpful. I didn't mean it like that. But we didn't have a full picture of the problem.
And more time would have been nice to interview patients in other areas of the country. We were really in the capital and then in one adjacent district. So, yeah, 50 patients isn't a lot, but kind of gives a window into what's going on.
Do you have any information about folk remedies for treatment of TB? I know that, for example, a century ago, people in, let's say, the central part of Russia, Tatarstan, Bashkortostan, and also, I think, among Kazakhs, They use the kumis, which is fermented mare's milk, as a kind of traditional treatment. And I have no idea if it has any efficacy at all. And I think even in Kazakhstan, they have like there may be some sanatoria where they use that as a treatment. Have you come across anything about whether any of these traditional treatments have any efficacy?
You know, it wasn't mentioned with any of the patients that we talked to. And, you know, we talked to them about if they'd taken anything else, you know, to treat side effects even. And, you know, yeah, folk remedies didn't really come up. But then again, we didn't travel to some of the more remote regions in the country, and it's possible that they're using them. And I don't know about any research that's being done on the efficacy of them either.
No, I mean,
yeah.
Good question.
But yeah, it's interesting.
In terms of patients not taking the full course of treatment, you referenced the educational problem and also the financial problem. Was there any evidence or sense of like a distrust of medical personnel playing into it, like any cultural element like that?
Not too much, I would say.
More that
they just weren't getting the message, I think. It was interesting because we asked them, are you supposed to be observed every day? And they would say yes. It's clear that for MDR, they're getting the point that, okay, this is serious. You need to be observed every day. But, you know, you can prevent some of those cases from even arising if there is better education about classical TB. And as it's become a growing problem, this will be addressed better. But I didn't get that sense. The patients have a very close relationship with the providers. A lot of the providers go out to meet them in their homes, and I got the sense they felt pretty well cared for.
Yeah, I think to some extent there was a fear of people finding out, though, and there was one interview that I participated in. This is an isolated case, but it was a really interesting story of a woman who had gone to her local doctor and been diagnosed with TB, and her husband then called the doctor or went to the clinic, I don't remember, and asked him, you know, what's wrong with my wife? She wouldn't tell me. And he told him that she had TB, and that if he stayed with her, that all of his children, all of his unborn children, would be infected with TB. So then he abandoned his wife, and she moved back into her mother's home at that time. So, I mean, I think, you know, just hearing that story, and I think there is maybe a little bit of distrust, but that's why these community treatment models are so encouraged, and working with people that aren't necessarily healthcare workers, but more like Red Cross volunteers, because they're more than capable of going to people's homes and observing them taking their treatment. And I think if you know somebody in your community that's working with you, then you're much more likely to trust them. And, yeah, so it wasn't a major issue, though.
Did you have a question?
Well, I was going to ask whether there's any higher level discussion with the government about the treatment of regular TB as a cause of this MDR TB, and whether they're, I don't know, what is the sense that, is it worse to, I mean, it seems like if you start it and stop, that's bad, but is there a kind of recognition that they need to really do something about this first line treatment and the inadequacy of that to stop the proliferation of the, besides treating it, just preventing it from occurring?
It seems like the healthcare workers are kind of getting a sense of that, but as you know, if they had these machines where they could rapidly determine if it's drug susceptible or drug resistant, that would really help. And so they definitely will need government support for efforts like that.
I think there hasn't been a lot of like public health work though recently. A lot of funds directed at public education around TB and preventing the spread of TB, from the beginning of things, would prevent MDR and all of these other issues down the line. This CAP survey that was done a couple years ago, Knowledge, Attitudes, and Practices, tried to get at, what are people not understanding about treatment for classical TB that is causing them to go on and then develop MDR. So, the mystery of health and USAID seem to have a pretty strong working relationship at this point. So I think they're moving towards some solutions. And hopefully, yeah, the funding, I think, from the Global Fund is a major issue, though, as well, that needs to be secured.
Has Russia expressed any interest in taking care of this problem? Because with such a large migrant workforce, it seems like that would be like an issue very pertinent to them and their public health system.
Yeah.
That is a great question, and I don't think they're really taking ownership of the problem. Like, for example, these patients who contracted in Russia, they're poor to begin with. The working conditions they're in, you know, kind of lead to this happening, and Russia doesn't appear to be, from what I know,
reaching out,
taking it on.
I think it's really hard to access healthcare if you're Tajik and you don't have the right documentation when you go to the hospital. I think you're mostly paying out of pocket to get some care. Yeah, and from our discussion with the IOM office in Dushanbe, it seemed like neither government was really taking ownership of the migrant situation. So.
I mean, it's certainly in everyone's best interest to own their part of the problem, because it will become their problem, even if they don't think it is. So.
Thank you, Sam.
Can I just ask, are you doing any other work, or do you know if other people are doing work looking at the other Central Asian countries? Because I noticed on your initial slide that Kazakhstan also had a really high rate, over 50%.
So this USAID project is actually being implemented in five Central Asian countries. Mm-hmm. So, the monies are pretty equally distributed, and there's offices in all of those countries, and they're working with other partner organizations in those countries. I don't know specifically like how successful they've been with MDR rates in the past couple of years in those countries, but I think it varies substantially. And I think the program is, from what I understood, is kind of just getting going in like Uzbekistan, whereas in Kazakhstan it's been, you know, in place much longer. And stuff like that. But I think,
sorry.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but do you know, on your graph again, there were some other areas that are very resource poor and have gone through a lot of like social upheaval, especially like some of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, but the rates were nowhere near the rates in Tajikistan in that area of the MDR-TB. Do you have any idea why that is?
Yeah.
For the ones that were shown, I can't say offhand, but there's a deficit of data too from a lot of these countries, so it's possible that it's high and just unknown.
The only explanation I've heard for, you know, MDR rates being so high in the former Soviet Union is really, you know, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the lack of economic support in that way, and then subsequently the civil war in Tajikistan, all the social upheaval is really what caused these rates to skyrocket. But you would expect it in other countries that have experienced a similar thing, but yeah.
But the Soviet Union had a certain level of health care, mm-hmm. that I presume is superior to that you had in a lot of African countries.
Yeah.
So I think if the extent to which a lot of that is people who had treatment and then stopped, you know, might mean that you had more people starting treatment and stopping in the former Soviet Union. Mm.
I think some of it may have just been the DOTS program as well, like how early it was put into place in Africa versus the Soviet Union. And, but it's very striking.
I guess like a question that kind of goes along with that is like, why TB and not HIV?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, well, HIV rates have risen in Tajikistan as well, and actually Tajikistan had polio epidemic a couple years ago, and I mean, we were so close to eradicating polio globally, and Tajikistan was like one of the few places where it kind of came up again. So like infectious diseases in general have seen a resurgence.
It's hard when, you know, a lot of the providers we talk to, they're intelligent, they know what to do, they know what needs to be done, but they don't have the resources often to do it. It's just a frustrating observation, but they're still very committed to the patients.
Well, thank you so much, everyone.
Thanks for the good questions.
Thank you. Yeah.